stays the same for long hair. Right, one of the great things about this Zendo is for the first time you can keep your shoes and jackets indoors. To those of you who haven't been at our old Zendos, it was always a little more primitive. This is the lap of luxury, more or less. Well, I've been talking the last few weeks about the mind of equality in various ways, looking at it from one side and another, the inclusive view that sees the equality and perhaps sameness of all things, what we all share, what is not just as a little in a little corner of ourselves, but that is who we are, that we are in common, and that sees simultaneously the difference, that is who each of us is, and sees the equality of those two and the non-separateness of them. Because things are never equal if they're separate. You know, we know separate but equal doesn't work, right? We all saw that. So you can't say, oh, on one hand there's our differences, and on the other there's what we share and have in common, and they're different realms but somehow equal. For things to be truly equal, they have to be simultaneous. So in some way, what we have in common and what is different about us are simultaneous. They're the same things. So since that's not easy to wrap our minds around, I've been talking about it from various different sides. And this phrase, mind of equality, is a way to describe what goes on in the more common traditional Zen term or phrase of magnanimous mind or big mind. When I started out in Zen, I heard about big mind, and it sounded great. Right? It sounded like a great state that I could accomplish. I could achieve this. Maybe. No, I worked really hard. Maybe I could achieve this. And accomplishment I might have if I did enough, strenuous enough zazen. And I was young and diehard, and we were doing a kind of strenuous Zen in those days anyway, and so it all seemed like that was the way to go. And I don't know, some of you, I'm sure, many of us come in with some idea like that. That I could, or you could, achieve some wonderful, specific, different condition if you worked at it hard enough, if you pushed hard. And getting past that often feels like disillusionment. It isn't going to be great like that. I'm not going to have a fine, high, knowing state completely beyond my ordinary state of mind. Giggle. She's been doing this a long time. Disillusionment upon disillusionment, right? And it's so important to stay with your practice at that point. That's a place where it gets really hard. It's okay. It's hard enough to say, okay, maybe I'm going to do or I don't want to do strenuous effort, but you know, we feel, oh, I can achieve something, we'll throw some effort into it and we're going somewhere, and then we say, well, you know, all this exertion isn't leading to what I thought it would lead to, and disillusionment sets in. So that disillusionment, you know, maybe you at that point you don't have confidence in your practice or even in Zen or the Dharma. And it's very difficult then not to think that disillusionment is the final word. Just as the idea that I'm going to do this practice seemed like the great way forward, then disillusionment feels like the great no way forward. You know, now it's completely disillusionment. I had a dream in which I was in an alley that became a tunnel and it was stone when I finally... And I finally hit a dead end. And that's what it feels like, disillusionment. So there's nothing there but more stone. There isn't is there isn't a forward, what are we going to do? There isn't really a going back in our lives, and you can't go forward into this stone. There's this disillusionment, and you can feel difficult and stuck there. You can come to that in your practice or in some other area of your life. Sometimes some people come to Zen because they're already in that kind of pressing, no way forward, no way back, sense of disillusionment. And Zen isn't opening out because it's something you can do. And then at some point, perhaps, you say, oh, it's just one more place, one more dead-end tunnel, one more disillusionment. But in fact, in Zen, in your Zen life, that's just one more a condition, almost a stage. We don't really, Zoto, going for a lot of stages and levels, but in a sense, there are stages we go through, maybe more than once. So in that sense, you don't get to climb a little staircase. But to be able not to think that your disillusionment is the last word, to hold your seat, to stay put, to keep doing it. Even if you kind of think disillusionment is true, this is it. When you can say, oh, I'm going to keep on doing this, you're already saying, actually, I'm setting something on the other side. Maybe disillusionment is not a complete picture because I'm also still doing this practice. Now, this practice says, just come and sit down. Bring your illusion, bring your disillusion, bring your inspiration, bring your lack of inspiration, bring your devastation, whatever you've got, bring your joy. It's here. You can sit down in the middle of it. And this is when you begin to get a sense that you can do zazen, that this practice is a kind of container for all of those states. That is the beginning of a settling and a sense of stability. That's the beginning of the mind of equality. This awful state, this wonderful state, both of them have a home here. At that point, we can recognize or live out, recognize with our bodies, that what we think of as fine and high and what we think of as ordinary and dull, they are not comprehensive views. They are vital and intense views that we hold, real strong opinions about who we are in our life at that moment. But they are opinions that are part of a larger whole. And if we hold still, if we in ourselves, not to say, rigidly not moving, but holding where we are, holding our seat, holding our place, we can contain that state and whatever else there might be, because that already then allows for the possibility of change. So humility and hope are called for at this point. My strong opinion isn't the last word. Well, it feels like it, but it isn't the last word. That's both humility and hope. And encouragement from outside helps here too. Dharma talks help, having Sangha helps. I used to live alone in the early years, and so I would just read another inspiring Zen book. And there's always another one coming out because we need them. I guess I should say that in line with that one of the great providers of those inspirations died this week, Daido Luri, who wrote, boy, a number of, this is Eight Gates of Zen and Arrows Meeting in Midair, a number of books, and started a very big center. I had many Dharma students, and Dharma eras, and was one of the first and oldest of our sort of what we call second generation Zen teachers, the ones whose teachers were Japanese and are here now, the main body of American Zen teachers. So that particular stream of inspiration has now exactly dried up but shifted. His students are, I think, already writing books now. So it's not just that Zen produces a lot of words, but there's the attempt to find a fresh voice and expression for that encouragement that we all need periodically at different times. It's all right to need it. So your truth and your life lie beyond the limiting quality of your views. My limiting views, my narrow ideas, my ideas of what's right and what's wrong in my life and in yours, all those ideas are part of who I am, but they do not define me. They are just part of what's running around in here. They are not our truth in our life. Big mind is not somewhere else that removes you from your inherited accumulation of all you've done and been in your life. Sometimes we would like it to. I'd like to leave it all behind, pack it up and send it to general delivery and not pick it up. But in fact, too much would be lost. All the flavor and richness and the individuality of who you are, that's where big mind and small mind all take place. That's where the mind of equality takes place. That's the individuality that is you. So you don't want to give that up. But we want to come to an inclusive view that allows for our having these small and narrow views, allows for our disillusionment, and doesn't get so thrown over by them that it knocks our life over. Almost sometimes, but not quite. This inclusive view sees equality and sameness and differentness and non-sameness of all things, and allows us to settle down here, because nothing has to be, we're not busy shoving things out the door. We're saying, okay, here, I can stay here with what comes up. In itself, one of the great stabilizing aspects of Zen practice. So this inclusive activity of your body and mind, because this holding your seat or staying put is an activity. Of course, there's nothing passive about it. I mean, quiet in your life is not passive. And there's always a sense of activity in our life. How are we going to handle that? This is what's called continuous practice. The attitude that I can be here and receive and act and meet and respond to the various kinds of things, my narrow views, my big views, your narrow views, your big views, the things that come up. This is the being present and responsive to all of that is called continuous practice. The sense in which our life has no holidays. There's such a thing as setting things down, taking a nap or reading a mystery or a little escape. That's part of it too. There's no leaving your life. So that we can then give that a shape as continuous practice. A continuity in activity and at rest. Continuity of self and other. Continuity of sameness and difference. Especially that sense of continuity of moment to moment, meeting each moment. That's continuous practice. Not always meeting it well, but meeting it best you can. So continuous practice is a way to describe our magnanimous mind in a human form, because human form is always in motion. Human life is always active. So I've early on found that trying to see my approach or my attitude to the things that came up inside and outside as aiming at continuous practice was very helpful. Here's a phrase that comes from Dogen Zenji. Dogen said, in the great way of the Buddha ancestors, there is always supreme continuous practice, which is the way without beginning or end. So continuous practice is a phrase that says, this is a way to describe the Buddha way, being in the way. What does it mean to enter the way or be in the way or practice the Buddha way? Continuous practice. Because the way doesn't begin or end or stop. Therefore, you're meeting it and your life doesn't stop. And can I meet it as what I meet as my life? That's continuous practice. He said, Dogen didn't say all that. that's me. Dogen said, arousing the thought of enlightenment, that aspiration to wake up, the practice you do, awakening and peace that you find, and peace that you don't find, have not the slightest break, but are continuous practice that goes on forever. Therefore, it is neither one's own effort nor someone else's. It is pure, continuous practice that transcends the opposition of self and others. Now, I think for us there's a key I want to come down to, and that is that it's not your effort or someone else's. Continuous practice isn't just my effort. Now, when I do it as that, it's strenuous effort and I get tired. And that happens. And a lot of us who take that approach, we get tired and we say, well, geez, I can't keep this up. That's because we've lost track that it's not my effort versus your effort. It transcends the opposition of self and others. It's not others. It's not, I'm here, I have to move that boulder. Somehow, it's that meeting the boulder and myself where we're not in opposition. Sometimes I move the boulder, sometimes it moves me, sometimes we both sit there. I have a lot of rocks at my place. If anyone needs some rocks, let me know. I have piles of rocks to get rid of, which is unusual in California. New England, everyone has piles of rocks to get rid of because they come up out of the ground endlessly. It's a wonderful thing, you know, the glacial moraines, the New England, there's the freezing and thawing of the soil gradually moves rocks up, and huge boulders and little rocks, and they just move up and up and up, and the farmers would clear the fields and build those wonderful stone walls, and more rocks. There's more in there. But then I moved to California, and after I'd been out here, I've been to Minnesota and then in California for years. I was back one time visiting Ty, and we went for a walk up to someone's house where someone had a house site. It was all cleared and developed as a site, but they hadn't started building. And there was these wonderful big rocks, like you'd go to St. Johnson Rock on Santa Rosa Avenue and pay $100. I said, where did they get those rocks? And she looked at me like I was nuts. She said, out of the ground. You know, they came up, and they, you know, the bulldozer moved them over a few feet. So there are many ways to meet the rocks in our lives. And some of them are saying, please come and take them. And some are sitting there and watching them come up out of the ground. Many different kinds of stones. But it's not just, I am here, the stone is there, who's going to win? Well, that's our strenuous effort approach. It's okay sometimes to do that. I'm going to, you know, I was driven by a new house, and there's two ugly, supremely ugly brick pillars in front of the house. We've taken the lights off them, and we're going to take a sledgehammer this afternoon and try to knock them down. We have a little imported muscle to help us just in case we need it. So sometimes, yes, you say, I'm going to take my strenuous effort and knock that rock, right? That's fun, too. Or build a house with it. The other thing in New England now, the different ways things in New England, Tibetans, there was a bit of Tibetan settlement, a refugee settlement in Amherst, partly sparked by Bob Thurman in the 80s, and others. And so there's now a whole community there, as there are in many other places, of Tibetans. But there, these people who built their houses out of stone in Tibet have moved to a place where there's a lot of stone. And there are several families, extended families of stonemasons now, very active and successful in western Massachusetts, building beautiful stone walls, and maybe a cross between a New England and a Tibetan way. There are many, many ways to relate to the strenuous life of here I am and here's a boulder. We need a refine. So when Uchiyama Roshi talks about refining your life, he's saying, are there 10 ways you can relate to the boulder? Instead of the one, which is butting our heads up against it. We have to practice in a way in which there's no beginning and no end, in which linear time, which I will keep track of, is very important. So now I have to keep track of linear time here. I don't want to just run on forever and everyone gets tired and there's a rhythm to what we're doing here. So there's that way in which the differentness of 10 to 11 and 11:20 would be very, very different. It's not unimportant, this linear measuring and this specific details, but we want to move with them. I don't want to be in opposition to it. I don't want you to have to be in opposition to it. So we take care of that kind of linear side as part of our life. It's not an unimportant detail to be taken care of and mailed away somewhere. It's part of the flavor and description of how we live a big life. So we want to relate to time in more than one way, too. Then we can have continuous practice where time is linear and cyclical and circular and doesn't exist. In a very special time of Zazen, where time is, there's the bell rings and then there's, and then there's the bell rings. Is that time that happens in between there? I don't know. You could say it's time passes, and you could say it has nothing to do with time. Sometimes it's short, sometimes it's long. So we have to practice in a way where there is no beginning and no end. That's one another reason why I recommend, and every Zen teacher recommends, a regular practice. It doesn't necessarily mean every day. It doesn't say how long each time. A regularity, a knowing that come whatever particular state of mind and body and life, you're going to sit down again. You're going to sit down again. You're going to sit down again. And there's a great freedom that comes in that. A freedom, sometimes a freedom to endure unpleasant conditions, but there's a freedom from being stuck with only one solution, which is pushing the rock. So this continuous practice isn't just to have, say, 10 ways to relate to this moment or the boulder in front of you or the end of the stone, end of the tunnel. It's to take care of each moment as your life itself. Then your life and your practice are continuous. Are experienced as continuous. They're continuous anyway. Your life is continuous, but can you live it and act it as continuous instead of this kind of stop motion approach that we have? To take care of each moment as your life is to see Buddha in a blade of grass and to raise a temple with a leaf and to practice Zazen as Buddha life. It's called Buddha and Buddha. When you or I meet the moment after moment with this kind of openness to what this moment brings up, I will try to do my best to meet. We're not judging what we do. I'm going to do my best to meet it and be present with it and dance with it, move with it, respond to it. That's the moment of Buddha meeting Buddha. Back to Dogen, he said, handle even a single leaf of green in such a way that it manifests the body of Buddha. This, in turn, allows the Buddha to manifest through the leaf. You're not going to be, the leaf is not going to come toward you revealing its true nature as life itself unless you are also coming toward it knowing that you too are life itself and seeing that sameness or equality between you. This is a power which you cannot grasp with your rational mind. Well, you're not going to grasp it with your rational mind, and we're not talking about blind faith in Zen. It operates freely according to the situation in a most natural way. And this power functions in our lives to clarify and settle activities. He's saying that when you engage with each thing or each moment or each encounter as Buddha, then that being or moment manifests Buddha and reflects that back to you, and you know you interact in your truest self, Buddha to Buddha. This is part of why it didn't work, the whole idea of early in my practice and so many of us, that I am going to achieve a state of freedom, say. It's not something you do on your own. It's interaction. It's you meeting life, and life will meet you. Not on your terms. I'm sure Daido, like every other Zen teacher, is saying, I'm not quite ready. I'm not finished. I've got more students to complete training with. Handling each thing with the kind of the best respect you can bring to it, handling each thing as Buddha is the mind of equality. Because then each different thing is taken care of. And it's one of the things I liked in Japan was that you always use two hands on a thing. Of course, it's only more refined. Everyone is busy and they just do whatever they do. But there is a way of saying, oh, this is a clock. I'll use two hands with it. Handing things with two hands. Someone hands you a business card, they do it with two hands. This is the only thing I'm doing right now. And so there's this wonderful way of holding a teacup. One hand is under, one hand is around, and you're going to drink it. Right? Your whole self is engaged. And since we're kind of complicated critters, it helps if you put your two hands in the same place to do it. Because if my two hands are in two different places, they're doing two different things. You know, I write with both hands, sometimes simultaneously. No, usually only on one piece of paper. Not always. I was at Trader Joe's and I was writing on that little, the endlessly hopeful little slip about how maybe you'll get to win the lottery and $50 no one ever does that I know of. It's with my left hand while I'm signing the check with my right.
Oh my God.
I don't think I was taking the best care of either one, but I was hanging in there whatever way we can. So how do we do something where we gather ourselves together and meet the moment, meet each moment as our life itself? You don't have to use a word like Buddha. How do you meet this moment, each moment, as your very life itself? Sometimes, sort of haphazardly, we do that. Or by chance, or circumstance brings up in us. And we, you know, the first times when I felt this kind of vivid quality that I've gotten sometimes in Zen practice was before I started sitting. Some situation, some circumstance brings you to a clear, strong sense of being alive, of who you are, of what you're doing. Someone found that up on a ladder painting house. Suddenly, life was completely clear for that time. You don't have to do Zen practice to have that, but it's sort of haphazard. If it just happens to come or not come once or twice or three times in your life. It's important, but it just comes or doesn't. So to have a more, to be able to take more active part in this aspect of being present each moment in your life, one of the best things I can recommend is Zazen, right? Is where Dogen calls it taking the backward step that illuminates your life. The stepping back to an interior awareness of yourself. But it's an awareness of yourself is not apart from. When you're doing Zazen, you're aware of yourself, you're aware of yourself being here in a place, in a world, and with others. Or at least with other beings of one sort or another, if they're not human. So this backward step that illuminates your life doesn't just illuminate me. It illuminates your life. It doesn't just illuminate your personality or your personal psyche. That too. That's part of it. But it illuminates your life. I didn't understand that for a long time. I thought this was the backward step that illuminates my sense of myself or who I am or how I know myself. Well, yeah. But actually, it's a backward step, the stepping out from being actively moving my body and arms around to an activity that illuminates my very life. And that the same impetus that says, well, hold the cup with two hands or hold my stick with my two hands is this, in some ways the same that says, here's your Zazen, and you keep your hands here. You're holding your two hands in a very settled place. You're holding your body in a settled place, so your mind scampers around. Sometimes you have to move. That's okay. And then you settle down again. As we're trying to illuminate our life, and to do that, we have to be present. To be present, we have to be present in body and mind. They're not separate. So I always recommend that trying. It's hard even to notice that at the end of the Zazen bell, at the end of Zazen, we move and we get up without even noticing the radical change in our minds. Suddenly our mind is a matter of this hand and that hand and what I'm doing in the cushion and completely absorbed in all this busyness. Where a moment ago, there was a different kind of presence. And to be able to continue to be present, taking care of what there is to be taken care of, moving from one activity to the next, from zazen to the next. It's very interesting just to see how little we do that. So stepping back is an integral part of stepping forward and engaging. They are not separate, ever. Zazen is never a separate activity from your life. So this power that Dogen called Buddha to Buddha, the Buddha to Buddha functioning of life, is not graspable with a rational mind, but it operates without hindrance and according to the specifics of each situation, quite naturally. We have greater natural ability as people, as humans, as animals, beings, than we know. What we need to do is to become aware of who we already are and then refine the way we express that interactively. It's never something that I do just by my own powers, nor is it something that happens to me. It's interactive. And over again, our sense of what we're doing will slip away. The sense of continuous practice that means so much to me slips away, and there I am being caught up in strenuous effort again. But Zazen and this backward step is still there, and it will gather me up, and I will sit down, and then I will have this opportunity to be present in my life, to know myself again, and then to step forward again. It's a very deep practice, quite beyond your sense of whether you're good or bad at it. And remember, I was talking about the two moons. Then the one who is busy and the one who is not busy are not two separate beings. Does a phrase like Buddha to Buddha sound encouraging or off-putting to people? I always wonder. That's a question that I would wonder if anyone has a thought on. When I started talking at some point, I said, this is Buddha to Buddha life. And some people say, oh, that doesn't sound like me. I don't know. Or do people feel encouraged by that? Which comes from?